Support for St. Louis Public Radio comes from The Rep, kicking off its new season with Dial M for Murder. High suspense unravels on The Rep stage as a murder plot spirals into chaos. Dial M for Murder opens September 18th. Tickets at repstl.org.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking. The race between GOP U.S. Senator Josh Hawley and Democratic challenger Lucas Kuntz is likely going to be one of the most expensive and contentious contests on the November 5th ballot. But there's another candidate that's seeking to make an impact, Better Party nominee Jared Young. On the latest episode of Politically Speaking, Young explains why Missourians shouldn't have to settle for a Republican or Democratic option. And Young also details his positions on a number of hot-button issues. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
My promise to St. Louis was that I would do the absolute most for each and every person, starting with those who have the very least.
What I wanted to do was look and see what other states are doing.
We have to be willing to change those laws, that they are balanced and they affect everybody equally.
As somebody that grew up in the St. Louis area, in North St. Louis County, I didn't know any lawyers growing up.
We got to find long-term solutions to make government better, but also to be able to provide services to people.
I don't want to leave that federal money that we've been leaving all these years on the table.
We need to be spending this money to take care of Missourians.
I thought we accomplished a lot this year, but a lot more needs to be done.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio political correspondent Jason Rosenbaum. Joining us in studio, he is running for the U.S. Senate, but not as a Republican, not as a Democrat, but as a member of the Better Party. Our guest today is
Jared Young.
Welcome for the first time on Politically Speaking. This is your first time running for office. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. And I'm glad to be here.
Before we ask you about your specific bid for this and your candidate positions, I'd like to know a little bit more about you. Where did you grow up? How did you get interested in Missouri politics? And I guess where you went to high school, I suppose.
I don't think people care too much where I went to high school. I grew up all over the country, so hit every time zone, California, Utah, Texas, Pennsylvania, settled in Missouri in 2015. So brought my family here for a job, and it's actually the 9 years I've been in Missouri is the longest I've lived anywhere in my life.
Wow. Really?
Yep.
Wow. I can't really relate to that because I've only lived in two places, suburban Chicago and Missouri. So, and I've lived in different parts of Missouri, but it's been basically half and half in each place. Was it disorienting, moving around so much?
Yeah, there were definitely, you know, like anything in life, there were good things and bad things about it. Certainly got uprooted a lot and had to make new friends a lot. But what it means is I have friends all over the country, and I have a feel for every part of the country and what it has to offer. And really, it's given me a greater appreciation for just the variety and diversity we have in our country.
Now, you said you moved here for a job. I'm not going to ask you your specific employer, but like, what do you do for a living besides run for office?
So I'm trained as a lawyer, but actually came here to leave the legal profession and start running a business. So for the last 9 years, I ran a mid-sized business in Southwest Missouri that serves businesses all over the Midwest.
So you did not find the practice of law to be particularly appealing.
No, I practiced in D.C. for a little over a year, and it was rough on a young family, I'll say that. I have six kids now. The practice of law in a big city is not a family-friendly endeavor.
Six? I thought having three kids was challenging. How is it having six? I wouldn't know because I only have three.
It is super fun and super exhausting.
All right. Let's talk about this campaign. First of all, why did you decide to run for the Senate on this Better Party ticket as opposed to as a Republican or a Democrat?
It's a good question. Obviously, one that I get asked a lot. You know, I got interested in politics because of the level of frustration that I have, especially over the last 10 years, of just our inability to talk productively with each other and actually work together to solve problems. And I felt like If I was going to get involved, if I was going to step up and run for office, I had to do it in such a way that I could stay true to my values and actually accomplish the thing that I think needs to be accomplished. And I just don't think that can be done as a Republican or a Democrat right now. So I stepped up. I didn't originally intend to create a new party, just planned to run as an independent. But as I sat down and figured out what needed to happen to get on the ballot as an independent, I discovered I could either expend a whole bunch of resources to just get myself on the ballot, or I could expend the same amount of resources and create a new party and get other like-minded moderate independents on the ballot along with me.
Are you the only person, though, running as a better party candidate in Missouri this year?
This cycle, there's one other candidate. He's a congressional candidate here in the 1st District. Actually, his name is Blake Ashby.
Oh, I know. I know Blake Ashby. He used to be a Ferguson City Councilman.
Exactly.
Okay. I'll be candid here. I find third parties to be very fascinating, but in the history of Missouri, they have not been particularly successful in statewide races. There's been instances where independents have won aldermanic seats. There's been a couple of instances where I think they won state legislative seats, but never for statewide office. That seems like a pretty big barrier for you to accomplish your goal of winning. How do you plan to overcome that historical precedent?
Again, that's a question I get asked a lot, obviously, but here's the reality of where the Missouri electorate is right now. We have about 30% of Missourians that are hardcore Republicans and feel like every problem would be solved if we just got rid of the Democrats. We've got another 20 to 25% of Missourians that are hardcore Democrats and feel like if we could just get rid of the Republicans, we'd be okay. The rest of us, 40 to 50% of Missouri voters, are really sick of both options and incredibly frustrated and exhausted by the state of our politics and are desperate for something different and something new. And so that's what our polling showed before I ever jumped into this. It's what our polling has continued to show, and it's been validated by all of my interactions with voters throughout the state. There's a real longing for this. The presidential race, especially when it was Biden versus Trump, really contributed to that. You know, people just thought, really, this is the best that they can give us. You know, the dynamic shifted a little bit with Kamala Harris.
No, it shifted a lot. I mean, RFK Jr. was polling in the double digits, and now his campaign could end by the time this comes out because, you know, they made the switch. I don't think any of the third-party candidates are going to be relevant this year because of the change.
Well, there's a difference in the presidential level, right? There's a much higher barrier to win as a third-party candidate on the presidential level.
I would say it's damn near impossible.
Right.
We're not Canada. We're not a European parliamentary system. I think it's going to be one or the other.
Right. So the Electoral College provides that barrier. But in a race like mine, all I need is a plurality to win, right? Mm-hmm. And it's clear that there's a strong plurality of Missouri voters who want something like this. So the challenge for us this year is not actually persuading people that we need something like this. The challenge is just convincing them or making sure they're aware that there's a viable, legitimate option out there, and then obviously persuading them that option has a shot.
So you got to you were at the state fair.
Yeah.
That's where I met you for the first time. You certainly witnessed the interesting spectacle when Josh Hawley was making a speech at a Farm Bureau event, and then union members interrupt him. Did you happen to see Lucas Kuntz and Josh Hawley interact with each other at all?
Yeah, I was about 20 feet away from them as they were in each other's faces there at the ham breakfast.
What did you make of that situation? Because it has certainly gotten a lot of attention in Missouri, but it's also gotten some attention nationally. And I think that from talking with you, your view of the whole, what I like to call it, the Sedalia skirmish, but other people could call it something else. I think you have a different view of it than others, and I'd be interested for you to explain that.
So there are a couple of different things that it makes me think about. One is it was a spectacle, and I think that's what our politics has become completely about now. It's about spectacles. It's about showmanship. It's about getting as much attention as possible so that each campaign can then put up their clips on social media and fundraise off of it and just get as much attention as they can. But there's no substance there. We have performers, but we don't have people who are actually interested in talking about issues and thinking through the ways to actually solve those issues. We're facing a lot of complex problems, and we're not going to solve them by just hurling insults and screaming in each other's faces.
All right, let's talk about those complex issues. We'll start off with immigration. If you ask somebody like Josh Hawley, he's going to say, let's completely shut down the border and create the most strict immigration regulatory system as possible. I think Kuntz wouldn't probably go as far, but he has recently released an ad talking about getting tough on immigration. And I'm being kind of like general there. You can go on the internet and figure out his position. How would you approach immigration if you're elected to the Senate? And how would you approach it differently from Hawley or Kuntz?
I feel like there are so many areas where there's actually pretty broad consensus among the voters, but we're not able to make any progress in actual policymaking because of the vitriol, because of the partisan games where people don't want to give each other a win. And I think immigration is actually the perfect example. Most Americans acknowledge two things about immigration. One is we need a secure border. The second is we need legal immigrants. They're an incredibly important part of our economy and an important part of our culture. And so it shouldn't be that hard for us to come up with policy that acknowledges both of those truths, that makes sure we know who's coming into the country. We've made a decision. This is who we want. This is who we don't want. We let in the people that we want. But at the same time, making it easy for the hardworking, America-loving people that we need to come in to fill jobs, to grow our economy, to get in here without too much of a problem.
How exactly do you secure a border that is several thousand miles long, has terrain that makes building a wall very difficult? And the question I've always had for people that say build a wall, like how do you prevent people from flying over that wall or digging under that wall? Which sounds crazy, but like in a border that large, you can't monitor every square inch of it.
Yeah, so I actually, you know, my first summer of law school, I interned at the U.S. Attorney's Office in San Diego. And that U.S. Attorney's Office is 100% or 99% dealing with border issues. And so actually, I walked the border with the Border Patrol. And so I'm familiar with at least a pretty good portion of that border and what it looks like there on the ground. And you're right, it's impossible to completely stop the flow. But what's happening right now is the flow is coming across, and the flow is bigger than ever because once they get across, they basically turn themselves in, they go through some processing, and then get turned loose into the public and told, you know, come back when your hearing is. But that hearing, because we're so understaffed, is going to be, you know, a year from now, 18 months from now. And that's the problem. We just have created incentives for the people to come across, and that's what we have to do is eliminate the incentives. We need to staff up on the immigration judges so those cases can be processed more quickly. We need to have honest conversations about, okay, what is a refugee? What kind of refugees do we want to accept? And just, again, we just have to have the conversations. But when we're talking about securing the border, the wall gets a lot of attention and it's flashy and it makes for good chants. But really, I think we just need to be leveraging technology better. I think we'll spend our money better to just leverage the technology that's available to stop people from coming across illegally rather than building a wall.
I think that the reason why people are coming to this country is they're often coming from places that are going through severe economic hardships. As much as I would like to say the United States could provide aid to Central and South American countries that are in cataclysmic free falls, we just can't. Like, they eventually countries have to figure out their issues by themselves. But like, I don't see people stopping coming to this country as long as that dynamic exists. So is there a part of this solution that includes providing some sort of small amounts of aid to those countries to help deal with problems that are causing people to leave in the first place?
Potentially. I mean, those are the kinds of ideas that could make a lot of sense, and then we need to have earnest discussions about it. And that's the problem, is we're not having earnest discussions. I think we need to recognize in all these conversations that these are human beings and that we need to have compassion about them, but also acknowledge exactly what you said. We can't help everyone in the world that we want to help, and so we just need to have good discussions about who we are going to help.
Well, let's move on to an issue that seems to have popped to the top of the presidential race, and that is child tax credit. I'd be interested to hear if you think you have six kids,
yes.
So you utilize the child tax credit.
Yes, I
utilize the child tax credit. Frankly, after the American Rescue Plan was passed and we started getting monthly amounts of money, that really helped us with groceries and daycare and things like that. But that disappeared. I think Republicans are leery of going back to that sort of system, but they have been amenable to raising the amount of money per child for the child tax credit. What's kind of your thought about that entire debate?
I think it's a challenging balancing act because one of the things that's of biggest concern to me is our deficit spending and our national debt. And so, you know, all government spending has good intentions behind it and accomplishes some good. Maybe not all government spending accomplishes some good, but certainly we don't just come up with programs to throw money away. There's always a reason for coming up with the programs. But we've gotten ourselves to a point where it's just out of control. And so we need to think really, really hard about where we're spending our money. And there's going to have to be difficult decisions. So anytime I hear about any suggestion to spend more money, I get hesitant and think like, whoa, wait, like we need to tap the brakes and we need to be willing to have hard conversations about where we're putting government resources.
Do those hard conversations include making changes to Medicare and Social Security? And by changes, I mean either like raising the retirement age or for some Medicare patients, larger co-pays. I don't know exactly what we would be talking about here, but those particular programs could potentially run out of money, especially Social Security.
Right. I know it's not politically popular to say, but anyone who's serious about tackling those issues has to recognize that those options need to be on the table. Now, we can't touch it for people who are already relying on these programs, but certainly people like me, we can make changes that will make the program solvent, that will, you know, harm me 30 or 40 years down the road when I'm utilizing the programs. But it has to be done. The only other option is we do nothing, and 10 years from now, there's cuts across the board because we didn't have the courage to do anything about it.
I'm not 100% sure about the timeline, but I do think that there are going to be some tax cuts that were passed under President Trump's administration that are going to be coming due maybe in the next couple of years. How are we going to approach that? Because on the one hand, if you let them expire, that could be more revenue to deal with the deficit and the debt problem. On the other hand, if they completely expire, it's a massive tax increase for everybody, including middle and lower class, lower working class people. What's kind of your thought process on that?
Again, we just have to be able to have the conversations and figure out here's where we want to put our resources. And here's where we're not going to put our resources, but we have to get the debt under control. And so if we're going to extend those tax cuts, there have to be other decisions made that will offset that foregone revenue.
We'll be right back after this quick break with Jared Young, the Better Party nominee for the Missouri U.S. Senate seat.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.
And we're back on Politically Speaking with Jared Young. He is running for the U.S. Senate as a member of the Better Party. Now, let's shift to energy, which I think has become maybe less of an issue. I believe energy production has gone way up under the Biden administration. There has been a pretty sizable investment in alternative energy and environmental-related programs thanks to the Inflation Reduction Act. But I'm sure there's going to be other philosophical things that maybe not have passed under Biden, but maybe considered under a Trump or a Harris administration. What would be your approach to incentivizing clean energy more non-clean energy production?
So my view on energy production is that first of all, I feel like we have a duty as human beings to be good stewards of the environment. And so, you know, I'm generally for conservation for us individually and collectively taking steps to make sure we are taking care of the earth we've been blessed with. When it comes to green energy, I think that's the future. I think it's a future we need to be deliberately working toward. But I also think we need to carefully weigh the costs and the benefits as we are moving towards that future. And I feel like the Biden administration has gone too quick and has sometimes neglected to think about some of the potential costs of the things they're doing to kind of force us into that green energy future. And I also feel like sometimes they're a little bit too narrow in looking at the costs and the benefits of given solutions.
Can you give an example?
electric vehicles. So there's, you know, they've been trying to push an EV mandate, gone different ways about it. I think the infrastructure clearly is not there outside of Tesla. You know, Tesla has this great infrastructure, but anyone who buys a non-Tesla EV or rents one, as I've done before, recognizes that, oh, wow, it's a real challenge to get a non-Tesla EV charged right now. I think we need to recognize that the electricity that's charging those vehicles, you know, a lot of that's still coming from dirty energy. So we're not necessarily getting kind of the climate-saving benefit from the electronic vehicles that we think we're getting. So I think we need to get there. And I think there's a role for government to play in helping us get there. But I also think we need to just think about the timing. And I guess you can tell from the way I'm talking about it, but I don't view it as quite as urgent of an issue as some of the climate activists do.
Yeah, and I haven't read either the infrastructure bill or the Inflation Reduction Act, but my understanding is there's money to install electric vehicle chargers. It's just not going to happen right away. And I've heard that I've heard Republicans criticize the fact that not many have been built, but I've also heard counterarguments that just building a lot of chargers willy-nilly without thinking about where they're going to be is actually a bigger waste of money, and the methodical rollout of that makes sense.
Yeah, I've heard the same criticism as to, you know, several hundred thousand are supposed to be built. It's been 3 years, only eight have been built or something like that. And I don't know the reasons for it.
And I don't know if it's eight either. It may be more, but continue.
I think I just read it yesterday. It was eight.
Okay. Well, I'll take your word for it.
It was the Wall Street Journal, so take it for what it's worth.
Sure. Let's move on to abortion. How would you describe your position on abortion rights?
I would consider myself a moderate pro-lifer. So, you know, I have six kids, as we talked about. I believe being a parent is an incredible blessing, and I believe that somewhere along the line in that pregnancy, that baby becomes a human being and needs to be protected and deserves rights. I don't know that I necessarily believe it happens at conception, but certainly, you know, when I go into those 18, 19-week ultrasounds and to discover the gender of my baby, that really feels like a human being to me. It's an area where there's so many deep emotions. You know, I've sat at a table with the staunchest of pro-choice advocates, and I've sat at tables with the staunchest of pro-life advocates. And I think they are all coming from really sincere and, frankly, very rational points of view. And so it's one of these areas where you're not going to be able to convince each other simply by, you know, walking through it logically, because they're just operating from different premises. And in those kind of debates, that's where I think we need compromise. And so for me, a reasonable compromise, being someone who leans to the pro-life, is a 15-week ban with appropriate exceptions for rape, incest, and the life of the mother.
You would want that nationwide, or would you want it state by state?
I think it's incredibly important that it be state by state.
Okay.
Again, on an issue like this, where there's just no, you can't just logically talk about it and say, like, this is the best solution. I think it has to be a state by state decision.
So based off your answer, you are not in favor of the current status quo in Missouri, where it is a 0-week ban, no exceptions for rape and incest, only for medical emergencies. You would say that goes way too far for
yourself. That's correct. I think the current ban is too strict.
But also from your answer, it doesn't seem like you would be amenable to the abortion amendment, which would allow abortion up to fetal viability, which is usually between 24 and 26 weeks. So you're going to be voting no on that.
That's correct. I think the fetal viability is too wishy-washy of a term, and also it, rather than setting out to kind of establish a reasonable compromise, to me, it establishes a floor then that the pro-choice folks can negotiate from, and I think that's the wrong approach.
What about on guns? What would be your mindset when it comes to voting on certain types of restrictions for firearms?
So my thoughts on guns are pretty personal. You know, I live in Southwest Missouri. A lot of my friends have huge gun collections. I'm a gun owner. I enjoy shooting, but really a lot of my personal feelings on guns come from a personal experience, and that was in 2013. I lived in Boston, was going to law school, and that's when the Boston Marathon bombings happened. And they shut down the entire city. I don't know if you remember the story. So you had the two brothers that were responsible for the bombings. Several days after the bombings, they found them. There was this big police chase in the middle of the night across the city, and the next day, one of them had escaped, and they shut down the entire city. And the last place he had been seen was about half a mile from my house. And we were in lockdown in our house. I was there with two young kids and my wife, and literally a terrorist could show up at our back door, and I had nothing in the house beyond a kitchen knife to defend my family. And sure enough, he was ultimately found about a mile away from our house in someone's backyard. And so that experience to me really made me feel like, okay, never again will I be in that situation where I'm not in a position to defend my family. Do I expect to ever be in a position again where there could be a terrorist knocking on my back door? No, I don't. But that just brought home a whole different, thought process when it comes to the Second Amendment for me. So I believe the Second Amendment's important, and that right to bear arms and to be able to defend your family is important. At the same time, I think we have to be open to reasonable discussions about things that will keep guns out of the hands of people who are going to use them in bad ways, whether that's, you know, criminals or the mentally ill.
So I guess that would mean red flag laws would be amenable to you, because that creates we've talked about this on the show before, but red flag laws would set up a judicial type process where if somebody is accused of being a danger to themselves or others, a judge can determine whether to take their guns away.
Yeah, I think you have to be very careful and make sure there are appropriate safeguards in place so that you're not taking guns away from, you know, law-abiding citizens, and so that somebody can't just, you know, want to cause somebody a hassle and initiate that red flag process. But yeah, as long as you're thoughtful and careful about it, I'm certainly open to those kind of regulations.
Right. And also, I know that like mental health related things gets brought up anytime there's a shooting. Like, it's usually brought up among Republicans that don't want to do anything on guns. But the thing that I need to point out is not everybody with a mental health affliction is a danger to themselves or others.
That's true.
And I'm always going to push back against people who say, if you, let's just say, are diagnosed with, I'm going to say, bipolar disorder, mm-hmm. or ADHD or depression, then you suddenly shouldn't be able to have a gun. Because if somebody is treating all three of those things and they're not a danger to themselves or others, I honestly think that would be an equal protection violation question of just blanketly saying you can't have a gun.
Yeah, I agree. So again, we need to be thoughtful about these things, and they're complex issues that are going to need complex and nuanced answers. And right now, our politics are just not putting us in a position to have those kind of nuanced answers to these questions. But one other thing I want to mention when it comes to guns and violence, one aspect of this that we never talk about but I think is incredibly influential is just the culture of violence that we're cultivating in our society. Look at the video games and the movies and the shows that we watch. Anytime somebody goes on one of these shooting sprees, just think about how many times they've probably killed someone virtually or seen someone been killed. I think that has an influence on the level of violence in our society.
Yeah, I'm going to push back a little bit against that. I don't know. How old are you?
38.
I'm 40. So I went through the whole Mortal Kombat era too, and I never went and tried to like rip somebody's spine out.
Oh, but Mortal Kombat it pales in comparison to what's out there right now.
Yeah.
And Game of Thrones compared to something that was on TV in the 90s. There is a stark, stark difference in the graphic level of violence that's being put in front of our kids, in front of people today than in the 90s.
All right. Well, let's move on to one other domestic issue, marijuana legalization. I asked both Senator Hawley and Lucas Kuntz about whether they would want to legalize marijuana federally. It's already legal in Missouri, so this question is not relevant to whether you can buy marijuana or not, but it is very relevant to whether prospective businesses can get access to bank loans, because right now you can't. It also affects expungements on a federal level. It would obviously affect states that can't get marijuana right now. I'd be interested in your opinion about whether it should stay illegal federally.
Yeah, so I'm very familiar with the challenges that businesses face. I worked with businesses that were in the marijuana industry and have friends that work in the industry. I'm actually opposed, however, to the legalization of recreational marijuana. I support medicinal marijuana. I think it should be treated more like the other medicines we have out there, and less like, hey, pay $5 to get a card. I know this is the old regime, not the current regime in Missouri, but I am all in favor of people having access to marijuana for medicinal purposes. from the recreational standpoint, I think it's more dangerous than we give it credit for. And I just don't think we will be better off if more people are smoking marijuana or using marijuana.
I think one of the problems with the medicinal side is doing specific research on marijuana right now. It has been loosened, I think, since Biden took office, but it is still not enough to prove definitively, hey, this does good things to you if you have depression, ADHD, whatever, or it does bad things to you if you have depression, ADHD, or whatever. That seems to be like a baseline thing that needs to happen to allow more study of marijuana.
I agree.
What would you do kind of to remove some of those barriers on a federal level?
Yeah, we need to reclassify it so that it's treated more like something like morphine or codeine and less like cocaine and methamphetamine so that that research can be conducted and we can have honest conversations with real data about the impact of marijuana on our society.
Okay, let's move to foreign policy. If we're talking about complex issues, like right now as we're recording this, they're trying to get a ceasefire off the ground. Every day it seems like one step closer, one step back. I know this is a very emotionally charged issue where people have very strong opinions, but as a United States senator, you could certainly have an influence on voting for aid packages or using your platform to call for the administration to commit to a certain policy. I'd be interested to hear your general thought process on this.
So this is an area where I have a lot of experience and really deep feelings because my undergraduate degree is actually in Middle East Studies in Arabic, and I lived in Jordan. Lived among, 20 to 30% of the population of Jordan is displaced Palestinians. And so I have a lot of Palestinian friends, and I have a very nuanced understanding of the history there and how we got to this point. That being said, so here's my view. One, it's an incredibly difficult situation. If there was an easy solution to this, we would have solved it decades
or
ago.
Or if we had the solution, we would be multi-billionaires.
Right.
Because we would not be doing what we're doing
right exactly, now. Exactly. So there is no like solution to this that you can fit in a 30-second soundbite.
No.
I think the Israeli government has made a lot of mistakes over the past several decades in how they've treated the Palestinians and how they have slowly but surely made a two-state solution more and more impossible. And I understand the frustration and the hopelessness that Palestinians feel and which eventually leads them to lash out. I think lashing out is inevitable. That being said, I think what happened on October 7th is atrocious. And you're never going to defeat what they consider an oppressor. You would never defeat an oppressor by acting like the oppressor. And so I think there's no excuse for the sort of atrocities that happened on October 7th, and I think Israel is justified in responding. I think Israel has a duty, as they respond, to limit the harm to innocents as much as they possibly can. Now, we can argue about how much they've done that.
I think it's hard because Gaza is so densely populated and so urban, and and they're not, like, fighting. It's not like in Ukraine where they're like fighting in the middle of a field or something like that. But continue.
So my personal view is I think Israel has done an incredible amount to try to limit civilian casualties. I think Hamas has actively tried to maximize civilian casualties, which makes it even more difficult for the Israelis. What I think we should be doing as United States government is putting pressure on the Israelis not to necessarily end of the war or to tell them how to do the war, but putting pressure on them to have a clear plan moving forward. Because if Israel thinks that they can just stick with the status quo, we're just going to have the exact same thing happen in 5 or 10 years. We cannot move forward with the status quo.
On Ukraine, there has been a big split in this race between Holly and Kuntz. Holly has been a very vocal critic of aid to Ukraine. And while Kuntz, I wouldn't say, has been enthusiastic about the prospect of aiding them, he is supportive of still providing them weapons to repel Russia's invasion. Where do you kind of fall in the continuum there?
I firmly support aid to Ukraine. I think it's very clear that, Russia, Iran, China don't have our best interests at heart and are actually actively coordinating, trying to overthrow this world order that served us so well for the last 60 or 70 years. And I think we need to push back. And I think Ukraine is a perfect opportunity for us to push back and to get a win against Putin and his aspirations in a way that doesn't put American lives at risk.
And let's end this conversation with potentially the most frightening prospect, and that is Taiwan and China. I think that I've heard like rumblings for most of my life that China is going to invade Taiwan. If we're going to take like the, we got to be realistic with our foreign policy, the thing that I always keep coming back to is, how exactly is America supposed to stop a country that is three times the size of us and has a much larger army than us from taking over a country that, what is it, a tenth of the size, a 20th of the size? Like, I don't want Taiwan to be taken over by China. Like, I want to make that clear. But I'm not really sure if there's any amount of money that we could provide to prevent it from happening. Like, what's kind of your thought on this, given that, like, both of the candidates have very, both of the Republican and Democratic candidates have very strong opinions on this?
I think this is part of what's become so dangerous about where we've let ourselves get to. You know, one of the things I think the Republican Party used to believe in was peace through strength. The idea that the American military could be so powerful that it would act as a deterrent against any kind of aggression, like invasion of Ukraine or invasion against Taiwan. But we've reached a point where our allies no longer trust us and our enemies no longer fear us. You know, we've been investing less and less in the military. And don't get me wrong, I understand how much we invest in the military. It's still a lot. But in real terms, our investment in the military has been decreasing. And just generally, our willingness to engage over the last 5 or 10 years has been dropping. And you have people on both sides of the aisle that are advocating for kind of this isolationist sentiment. And I think that's emboldened actors like Russia and China, and they are testing, and Iran. They're continually testing us and pushing the envelope, seeing what we're going to do, and we have not reacted strongly, and so they will continue to push the envelope until we push back. So you asked specifically about Taiwan. That's a really tough question. I don't know. I think we have a duty to defend Taiwan. How viable that defense is and how likely we are to be successful in that defense is a tough question.
Okay, why do we have a duty to defend Taiwan when we won't even acknowledge that they're a country? I mean, I'm dead serious on that. I mean, it's kind of silly that we continue to play this like charade that we don't see them as a separate country because we don't want to anger China, but we are. So I have a lot of skepticism about like why we... In that situation, we would actually maybe deploy U.S. troops to defend a country we don't even think is a country. So I'd be interested
in that. So I agree with you on the ridiculousness of the kind of diplomatic charade that we do with regard to Taiwan. I guess I'm a little more hawkish when it comes to China, and I'd be in favor of actually recognizing Taiwan, even though, you know, that sends shockwaves through the diplomatic world.
Yeah, and that's not your choice. That's the president's choice.
Right.
But I understand.
But I would certainly support it if we wanted to take that step. And so... You ask, why do I think there's a duty? Same reason I think we have a duty in Ukraine. And maybe duty is too strong of a word. I think it's in our best interest. I think it's in our best interest to uphold the nations that are promoting the values that we have as Americans. But it's also in our economic interest because of the semiconductor industry that Taiwan controls. Obviously, we're taking steps to be a little more self-sufficient in that regard, but we're not there yet. It would have shockwaves and ripple effects all through the technology industry if Taiwan were to come under the control of China right now.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today. For all of our stories, go to stlpr.org. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is a part of the University of Missouri-St. Louis. And how can we find out more about your campaign, your platform on the World Wide Web?
VoteJaredYoung.com is where you can find me. That's vote, JaredYoung.com. Also, social media, it's at VoteJaredYoung.
Thank you very much. And until next time, so long. Politically Speaking is produced by Sarah Kellogg, Rachel Lipman, and me, Jason Rosenbaum. The show is edited by Fred Ehrlich. Read all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to Politically Speaking by searching the term Politically Speaking on Apple Podcasts. From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.